The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. And now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here, we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is on. Today, we're tackling fainting spells with guest expert cardiologist Dr. Ignacio Gallardo. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with 1,800 women, are both supported by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based health safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The results: better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We save lives and protect families. And so today, we are tackling fainting spells. And as I mentioned, Dr. Ignacio Gallardo is with me. And let me share a little bit about Dr. Gallardo with you. He graduated from the University of Texas in Austin with a bachelor's in chemistry. He attended the University of Puerto Rico Medical School and graduated from that institution in 1982. He did an internal medicine internship and residency at the VA hospital in San Juan, Puerto Rico from 1982 to 1985, and there he got a cardiology fellowship through 1988, became staff cardiologist until 1993. He then obtained a clinical cardiac electrophysiology fellowship at Georgetown University and then at Illinois Masonic Medical Center in Chicago. He is board certified in internal medicine, cardiovascular disease, critical care medicine, and clinical cardiac electrophysiology. He's also certified by the North American Society of Pacing and Electrophysiology, also known as the Heart Rhythm Society, and that is for device-based therapy. Since then, he has been in private practice until September 2009, just a few weeks away, when he will be joining the University of South Florida Medical School cardiology staff. His main interests are the evaluation and management of cardiac arrhythmias, syncope, and sudden cardiac death. And some of these terms we'll review right off the top. But at first, Ignacio, it's great to have you here today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be invited to this program.
Well, let's first start with some of these definitions for our listeners out there. What is a cardiac arrhythmia, and what is what's there about electrophysiology? What does that got to do with the heart? The heart's a muscle, isn't it?
Yeah, well, basically the heart is depends on electrical activity so that it can do the mechanical work of pumping blood. And electrophysiology is basically the field in cardiology that deals with all the heart rhythm disturbances of the heart.
Okay. So the heart, therefore the individual heart cell or cardiac cell has a certain rhythm which enables it to function and communicate with neighboring cells?
Yeah, well, the heart is a four-chambered structure, and there is an electrical impulse that starts in one chamber, which is the right atrium, and then it is transmitted to the rest of the chamber so there can be a synchronized contraction of the heart.
And if the heart is not contracting in a synchronized, organized fashion, then what can happen?
Well, patients can develop symptoms due to the hemodynamic the arrangement that it will produce. If the heart has, for example, atrial fibrillation, which is a heart rhythm problem in which the atrium is going very fast and doesn't contract well, and the heart is very irregular, well, that can compromise the blood flow and the cardiac output of the heart, and the patients can feel fatigue, have palpitations, feels an irregular rhythm. Sometimes they can even faint. They can have chest pain, shortness of breath.
So a variety of symptoms can occur if the heart is not pumping in a synchronous, organized fashion. Okay, and so electrophysiology is recognized as a critically important science, I guess, to understand the quality of the heart performance.
Yeah, cardiology has become so specialized, and now they have interventional cardiology, which we call the plumbers, and we have also electrophysiology, which they call the electrician of the heart.
Okay. And that's a particular area of interest of yours, and so in that area of subspecialization of electrophysiology falls, as you mentioned, atrial fibrillation, and what other diagnoses that our listeners may have heard about would fall into that category?
Yeah. Well, we cover from syncope, which is a transient loss of consciousness, rhythm disturbance atrial fibrillation, atrial tachycardia. Inappropriate sinus tachycardia, to ventricular arrhythmias, ventricular tachycardia, also bradyarrhythmias, which are the slow rhythms of the heart, like complete heart block, sick sinus syndrome. And then we also deal with the device therapy for those conditions, as well as ablative therapies, which are an interventional way of trying to cure this heart rhythm problems.
Okay, so these abnormalities can occur, as you mentioned, atrial fibrillation, perhaps one of the most commonly recognized and heard about diseases, and as well as other abnormal rhythms, such as a slower bradycardic rhythm, and you mentioned an abnormal fast rhythm as well, tachycardia. Mm-hmm. And this can be generated from both the atrium or the upper chambers as well as the lower chambers, the ventricles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the therapies fall into two major categories. One is a device category, where, if you explain that?
Well, basically, we always have the pharmacological type of therapy, and then we have the interventional. The interventional will require an electrophysiology study, which is basically the insertion of certain catheters in different parts of the heart, and then localizing where's the origin of the arrhythmia, and then we just burn it. We do an ablation procedure in which we interrupt that origin or circuit of the tachycardia. And then the other form of therapy would be device therapy, like implantable defibrillators, biventricular defibrillators for heart failure, pacemakers for slow rhythms.
Okay. All right. And, okay, excellent. So now I'm interested in the ablative procedures. What are some of the – maybe we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here, but since we started talking about it, at what point is there an indication to ablative procedure? And say, for example, in a patient with atrial fibrillation.
Well, not all the arrhythmias can be ablated. Mm-hmm. And this started about 20 years ago, involving basically what we call Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, which is an extra pathway that as people are born with, that will enhance their circuit rhythm in the heart. And we used to just look at that particular pathway and burn it. And that's how it started.
Let me just ask you, was it effective?
Yeah, no, it has been very effective, but it has taken time to perfection that technique. And then it has been then advanced to more other types of arrhythmias like atrial flutter, ventricular tachycardia.
An atrial flutter is an exceptionally fast.
Yeah, atrial flutter is a much faster arrhythmia, but it's organized. It's a big circuit that has a fast rhythm, but not as fast as atrial fibrillation. It's not as chaotic as atrial fibrillation.
How fast can a person with atrial flutter, how fast can a heart beat them in a minute?
The atrium will go around 300 beats per minute.
300 beats a minute.
But thanks God that we have the AV node, which is basically a filter that will control the passage of impulses from the atrium to the ventricle, so that it will block if it goes too fast. And then in that sense, you usually have a 2-to-1 AV conduction, which means that even though you have 300 beats per minute in the atrium, you're at 150 in the ventricle.
So the ventricle, which is, of course, the part of the heart that pumps the blood through the entire body, can actually beat at approximately 150 beats a minute
right.
in the setting of atrial flutter.
Right.
Is that how long can a person function?
If the patient doesn't have LV dysfunction and doesn't
which
have other...
LV meaning left ventricular.
Left ventricular dysfunction meaning that it has a good pump in the heart. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't have a weak pump in the heart and doesn't have other conditions like COPD, which is chronic lung disease, that will affect more the shortness of breath, they can become very symptomatic. Some of them can tolerate that. Interesting atrial fibrillation, which is a more chaotic rhythm, the atrium goes even faster, like 600 beats per minute, but thanks to the AV node, there's less impulses going to the ventricle, and then, interesting enough, you have a heart rate of 120, instead of 150 like the atrial flutter. Hmm. And people can even tolerate that even more because of the rate is much slower. Mm-hmm. So we treat medications to slow down the rhythm and try to convert the tachycardia, et cetera.
So in the setting of these atrial fibrillation, then, as you mentioned, you consider an ablative procedure if medicines don't work?
Right. Well, if for atrial fibrillation, which is really the really new thing in ablation nowadays, and which is the most common, chronic arrhythmia there is, there's some group of patients that will benefit from ablation and that it's advancing more and we're taking more of the chronic. Atrial fibrillation is divided into paroxysmal, which is just those who develop atrial fibrillation. It lasts for maybe a couple of days and it's spontaneously convert to the chronic permanent, which is the one that are atrial fibrillation all the time. And all what we do is give anticoagulation and give a rate control.
Okay, so these patients that have atrial fibrillation, they have to be on blood thinners.
Exactly. Yeah, most of them, there's a score that we look for risk factors. And if they meet two or more of those scores, those risk factors, then we recommend anticoagulation because the highest morbidity of this disease is clots and of course, strokes.
Okay, so patients with atrial fibrillation, because the heart's not functioning in a coordinated fashion, the blood will stagnate and develop clots, and those clots can be thrown up into the brain,
right.
And a person can develop a stroke and die.
Right.
So they're on typically chronic blood thinners, and of course, there's potential risks with chronic blood thinners.
Right.
The person can develop a hemorrhagic stroke mm-hmm. if they're over-medicated. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, there could potentially be a reason why you would consider you'd like to get off those blood thinners. So when we come back, we'll be back in a couple moments. But before we do, let me just say to our listeners, anyone you know with cardiac problems at all, and especially with atrial fibrillation or other cardiac rhythm abnormalities, today's your chance to call in and ask an expert. On the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, that's 289-1860, 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Elsewhere, it's 877-969-8600. Call in with your questions. We'll be right back.
Guten Tag. Enjoy the sights and sounds of Germany at the Schnitzelhaus while feasting on our award-winning cuisine. The Schnitzelhaus is open Wednesday through Saturday from 11 to 9, Sundays from 12 to 8. Lunch prices range from 6 to 10, dinner from 10 to $20. Please call us at 813-884-5634 to make dinner reservations or find our website at schnitzelhaustampa.com. Please visit soon at the Schnitzelhaus, 4333 West Waters Avenue, phone 813-884-5634, where the food is as authentic as the chef's accent.
America's digital goddess, Kim Komando here. Cameras, camcorders, home electronics, HDTVs, computers, online security, privacy, Facebook, MySpace, Blu-ray, and MP3s. Phew, it's a good thing I'm so very gentle on your ears. If it's in your digital life, it's right here on your radio. After all, they don't call me America's digital goddess for nothing.
Kim Komando, Sunday afternoon at 2 on Talk Radio 860 WGUL.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you.
Do your eyes have a foreign body sensation or are scratchy and sandy? Do they burn, sting, or itch, or are heavy and tired? Maybe your eyes are sensitive to light or your eyelids achy and sore. Have you seen countless doctors and still can't find relief? Have they told you, sorry, but you'll have to live with this and nothing can be done for you? Well, first, it's likely you suffer from dry eye. And second, don't stand for those answers anymore. Just because someone else doesn't understand your dry eye problems, go to the only eye doctor in Central Florida that specializes exclusively in dry eye and related diseases. Meet with Dr. Stephen Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where you will be given up to 2 hours of face-to-face time with a doctor to get at the root cause of your dry eye pain, fluctuating vision, and redness, plus begin targeted therapy right away. Haven't you waited long enough?
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
And welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We are discussing fainting spells and abnormal heart rhythms today with guest expert Dr. Ignacio Guillardo. And on the line is Angela from Tampa. Angela, welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic.
Hi.
Hi, do you have a question today for our expert?
I have quite a few questions.
All right, let's...
Let me start by saying that my mother had a cardiac arrest less than a year ago, and she was the 1% of people that survived it. After they implanted the defibrillator pacemaker, she went home and did quite well on a low-sodium diet and beta blockers and things like that. Just a little side note, after listening to this radio show, we found out that she also had undiagnosed obstructive sleep apnea severely for many years, and they put her on a CPAP, nasal pillow CPAP, and her ejection fraction went from 20 to 25% all the way up to 35%. So she was doing quite well until this problem she had with shortness of breath, and they found out that she had, is it atrial fibrillation?
Okay.
Is that what it's called? And they put her on Coumadin, and she's, you know, the shortness of breath, and they put her on Coumadin. And since then, she's done well on her blood test for the Coumadin, but they want to do a procedure. They say her defibrillator needs to be reset, so they have to this week stop her heart and then restart it or shock her to get it in rhythm. And I just want to know a little bit more about what the procedure is and the I guess, is this something that they're going to have to do a lot for her?
Okay, so Ignacio, at what point do you consider treating it or trying to, I guess called cardiovert, if I remember correctly, back atrial fibrillation patient back into normal rhythm.
Yeah. Well, first of all, in patients with heart failure or LV dysfunction, there's about at least 40-45% of patients that develop atrial fibrillation, and as we discussed before, there's multiple mechanisms for that. the problem is that when you have elevated dysfunction, you really need a normal rhythm as much as you can, because that will already there's compromise, you know, of the hemodynamics. So if she has an ejection fraction of 25, even to 35, and probably she has heart failure, the cardioversion is in an attempt to bring her back to normal rhythm, but hopefully she's on some antiarrhythmic that can prevent her from getting into atrial fibrillation. The problem is that medications are not a cure. They just control. And in atrial fibrillation, a success with the medication is to decrease the episodes, make them shorter, and make them slower so that the patient can tolerate them better. I have many patients with defibrillators that have atrial fibrillation, and usually what I do is I try to cardiovert them, not even with the external shock. I do them through the defibrillator. Now, it's important that they have been anticoagulated adequately for at least 4 weeks, four to 6 weeks, and then have, if not, the patient should get a transesophageal echo and make sure that there's no clots in the heart before there's a cardioversion.
Should get a what?
A transesophageal echo.
Transesophageal echocardiogram.
So,
okay.
Right, so it's the one that's, you know, you go into the esophagus, and then we look at the left atrial appendage, which is usually where the most, you know, common place for clots are. And if this is going to recur, yes, it's going to recur, because the same LV dysfunction will predispose the patient to get more and more atrial fibrillation, especially if the patient have hypertension also, which is another trigger for that. Now, there's medications that can help, and there's new medications coming. There's an actual approval of a new medication called dronadedron, which is the same as amiodarone, which is usually the most effective medication, but with no side effects. The other aspect of it is if the patient is having recurrent atrial fibrillation, and depending on the dimensions of the heart, an ablation of atrial fibrillation can be used. Of course, the more the patient has concomitant heart disease, the less successful is the ablation. But if we combine the ablation and the medication, that can make also a significant improvement.
I have a question. She has no heart disease, no clogged arteries, and she has no blood pressure issues.
But her LV...
congestive heart failure due to the sleep apnea for many years. So is she a better candidate for this?
Well, she has what we call non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, which sleep apnea can be the cause, but many times we don't know the cause of it. And the most common cause of that is a viral infection, but that's another story. But still, the number, the function of the heart, the ejection fraction is what really determines the risk of dying suddenly.
And you said she's about 35% now, Angela?
That's what her doctors recently told her from the last echo.
Right, 35%. And if the patient is on atrial fibrillation and they evaluated that in the echo, they may even underestimate the ejection fraction. It may be better. If they determine that during normal sinus rhythm, it's probably a more accurate way. But the sleep apnea is very important, the treatment that she has for sleep apnea, and definitely, you know, loss of weight loss and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the cardioversion, I don't know exactly how they're going to do it, if they're going to do it through the defibrillator or through the external paddles that we put on. The other question is if she has a biventricular defibrillator. Does she have one?
Do you know her, Angela?
She has a defibrillator?
Does she have a biventricular defibrillator?
What is that?
It's the common defibrillator, but it has an extra wire that will activate the left ventricle so that both ventricles contract more or less synchronized. And it has been shown that that's improved the function of the heart and also the survival.
Okay, could you tell me the name of that again? Because
Biventricular. Defibrillator.
Yeah. Defibrillator. Because she had last September in Illinois, she had it put in, and it was a pacemaker and a defibrillator. I mean, she was in VFib, but she was, you know.
Right. No, I think that is very indicated to have a defibrillator. The question is, depending on how much heart failure she has, and if there's some, that we look at some EKG markers and echocardiographic markers to see if she can benefit from this biventricular device, and that will be the way to evaluate, which will help for preventing more atrial fibrillation.
Angela, hang on. We'll be right back from a quick break with more on fainting spells with guest expert Dr. Ignacio Gallardo on the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic. Back in a flash.
With SRN News, I'm Michael Harrington in Washington. A top Senate Democrat says Republican votes will be needed to pass that health care overhaul bill. Budget Committee Chairman Kent Conrad made the comment on ABC TV's This Week program. Republican Senator Jim DeMint, who also appeared, says it could be possible in just a few weeks if the goal is not a government takeover, in his words. France's health minister says French President Nicolas Sarkozy fainted while jogging at a presidential residence outside the capital today. He's been hospitalized for tests. The minister is describing it as a small episode which can be caused by strenuous exercise when it's very hot. Iranian opposition leaders are pledging there will be no speeches at a memorial they're asking to hold for those killed in last month's post-election unrest. Opposition supporters say Iranian authorities have been pressuring the families of the slain protesters not to hold public memorials. This is SRN News.
Your premiums and out-of-pocket costs will continue to skyrocket.
So the president has made his plea during primetime for his health care plan. But do you buy it?
Scrap the plan.
Did he convince the rest of America that it's a good deal? And if not, is this a political disaster for the president and the Democratic Party?
Barack Obama is the quarterback. He's been calling the play.
Now, more than ever, we're giving you universal coverage of the health care debate. Talk Radio 860 WGUL.
Guten Tag! Enjoy the sights and sounds of Germany at the Schnitzelhaus while feasting on our award-winning cuisine. The Schnitzelhaus is open Wednesday through Saturday from 11 to 9, Sundays from 12 to 8. Lunch prices range from 6 to 10, dinner from 10 to $20. Please call us at 813-884-5634 to make dinner reservations or find our website at schnitzelhaustempa.com. Please visit soon at the Schnitzelhaus, 4333 West Waters Avenue, phone 813-884-5634, where the food is as authentic as the chef's accent.
Your host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. Dr. Maskin manages these dry eye disorders using innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has been successfully managing difficult dry eye cases for over 20 years and is board-certified, fellowship-trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and American Academy of Ophthalmology. He's been selected a best doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2009 and as an America's top ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America. We hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please, visit drmaskin.com, and if you have not found relief for your painful red dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, welcome back. Angela, are you still with us?
I sure am.
Okay. Angela's mom, how old is your mom now?
67.
67, and she had episode of cardiac arrest last year?
Yes, last September.
With a history of congestive heart failure, sleep apnea. She had a defibrillator pacemaker placed, as well as being treated with CPAP for sleep apnea, is on medication for atrial fibrillation?
On medication for for the other problems she had too, the beta blockers and everything.
Do you know if she's on a rhythm medication for her atrial fibrillation?
I don't know about that, but I knew she's on Coumadin. She's been on Coumadin. I'm not sure how long.
And that's to thin the blood because of the risk of stroke from the atrial fibrillation. How long has she been on Coumadin for?
That I'd have to find out. I would say at least a month, but I'm not sure.
One of the points that Dr. Gallardo was making before the break was, let me back up. Your mom is getting ready, I think you said, was it?
This week
coming to try and convert her atrial fibrillation rhythm to a normal sinus rhythm. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and Dr. Gallardo was saying he recommended that she be on Coumadin for at least 4 to 6 weeks.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right. And they have to be, every week they have to check the anticoagulation level that is therapeutic.
Right, and that would be an INR between, what's
two
called
an three.
INR, between two and three. For every week, for at least four weeks at least, before she's able, she should have this done to be sure that, or to be comfortable that there's no clots in the heart before she gets converted.
Right. Otherwise, then they will have to check if there is any clot in the heart with the transalveolar echo because the transthoracic doesn't show that.
Do you understand that?
Yes.
Okay.
She has been tested quite frequently for the blood test for the Coumadin.
Okay. So the other point that Dr. Guillard was making was whether she has a biventricular or both a lead in both ventricles on her defibrillator, and that's something that you can ask if you don't know.
And what's the benefit to that, doctor?
Well, in addition to have the benefit of the defibrillation is that by pacing all the time with this biventricular device, it can improve the synchronization of the heart and improve, therefore, the function of the heart. And so you get the extra benefit because the patient has better quality of life, and also it will add to her longevity. So it has been a big advancement in the management of these people.
And Ignacio and I were talking on the break. In some cases, it actually could increase the ejection fraction
10%. Yeah, but I even have seen people that haven't improved their number, but they have improved their congestive heart failure clinical picture, which in a way that's even more important because it's interesting that for the prognosis of this condition of congestive heart failure, the clinical picture is even more important than the ejection fraction. So you can have a patient with 40% of ejection fraction but being class 4 heart failure in terms of the clinical, which shows the decomposition of the cardiovascular system, whereas you compare that with a 20% EF in a patient that is class 2, that patient with class 4 is as bad or worse case scenario than the other patient.
So just in summary, so you're saying that you may have the ejection fraction doesn't tell the whole picture. You can still have congestive heart failure despite having a good ejection fraction. Go ahead, Angela.
So could I have her, has her doctor told her which class she falls into, do you think?
I don't know.
Is that important for a patient to know what class they are?
Usually we evaluate that in the visit when we see the patient and see what, you know, how compensated the heart failure is. Now there's more data coming now that before we used to do it at class 3, class 4 to put a biventricular ICD and a defibrillator, and now we are even going to class 2 with a recent trial that came by. And so we are very excited because even if there's no significant improvement in the clinical picture, there is reverse remodeling of the heart, and it can delay the progression of the disease. So,
any downside in getting a biventricular?
Well, it's a little bit of more hard wear, but basically now that the defibrillators are they look like the pacemakers used to look 30 years ago. So I think that it's a more complete device, and we have more freedom to do more things by programming the defibrillator. And not all of them will benefit from this. We have to evaluate what, you know, if they fall in this group that will definitely benefit. But when they're indicated, I think that we definitely should go forward with it.
That's something you can maybe ask your family.
I definitely will. Now, you just said class 2, 3, or 4, so 4 is obviously the worst.
Right.
Okay. The medication for atrial fibrillation, should she be on something like that?
Well, I think that she should have something to prevent recurrence of atrial fibrillation, and that has been the very tough part from the pharmacological standpoint, because the best drug we have still now is amiodarone, which is 68% effective to keep the patient in a normal sinus rhythm in a year. The problem with amiodarone is that it has other side effects, and one of the problems that we have with atrial fibrillation is that it interacts with Coumadin, and it's more difficult to control. Patient may be too anticoagulated, or the blood may be too thickened. So that's one of the counterparts. It has many other non-cardiac issues, but it's the safest antiarrhythmic in terms of the heart goes. It's the safest antiarrhythmic there is.
Yeah, but the other point that that Dr. Guiardo made is that there's a next generation amiodarone. How soon will that be available?
Well, we're hoping within a year or so that it's going to be available. It's already been announced.
Okay,
so.
And how do you spell that?
Sometimes it's very difficult. It's dronadadrone.
D-R-O-N-A-D-R-O-N-E-D-E-R-O-N-E. Okay. Okay.
So it's almost similar to amiodarone, but it's dronadarone. But what it does is that it doesn't have the non-cardiac side effects, which can be significant with amiodarone.
Very good. Angela?
Yeah, I'm just taking notes.
Good for you.
I have a couple more questions, and I'll let you go. What kind of therapy? You said something about medication can help the atrial fibrillation, but it's better if you – is there any way to correct it?
Well, yeah. The only cure we have for atrial fibrillation, unless we have a very classic origin of it, like hyperthyroidism. If you correct the hyperthyroidism, the patient may be already free of atrial fibrillation. But usually, especially when they have LV dysfunction, which is a weak heart, like your mom is, there's a high recurrence rate. I would say that 40-50%, even more. And that's because you cannot control the hemodynamics of the heart all the time. And maybe one time she may be too congested, and when there's congestion in the heart, there's stretching of the walls of the heart, which triggers atrial fibrillation. You can even have that with a normal heart. Patients that have hypertension, they have a thick heart, they have high pressure in the chambers of the heart, especially the left atrium. And that has been shown that it stimulates the triggers for atrial fibrillation. So I'm pretty sure that she can have, without seeing her, I can predict that she may have another episode. And usually if I'm going to cardiovert, it's having, you know, some medication on board to prevent its recurrence. Now, if the patient has a normal structure of a heart, some people just cardiovert either pharmacologically or electrically and then observe to see if there's any recurrence. But in your case, definitely I think that there should be some kind of antiarrhythmic agent.
And you also mentioned that they still need to be on blood thinners.
Blood thinner is very, very important. No matter if they tolerate, if they're asymptomatic, if they fall in the category of having two or more risk factors, which are hypertension, congestive heart failure, age over 75 years of age, coronary artery disease, previous stroke or transient ischemic attacks, those risk factors, if the patient have two or more, they are at risk for having at least 4-5% risk of thromboembolic events in a year, and is recommended by the guidelines to start the patient on anticoagulation.
Even if she gets cardioverted into normal sinus rhythm?
Because the problem, as we were talking about a while ago, is that people can also be in AFib and they don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very common. That's more common than what people think. And if you can, if you have an atrial fibrillation that lasts for at least 48, 72 hours continuously, that's enough to form a clot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have one that lasts for 10, 12 hours, that's low risk to develop a clot. But if you have the risk factors and you have a long-standing atrial fibrillation of 48 to 72 hours or more, definitely you can have a clot formation there.
And one more thing. You said the paddles versus the defibrillator.
To cardiovert.
Yeah, what is the advantage of that? Well, the problem with the paddles are that it's more painful, it burns the skin, and even though the patient's going to be sedated, the fact of doing it intracardially is that it doesn't damage or burn the tissues. It's just internally. However, it all depends. Some people do not convert with the defibrillator because the defibrillator was put basically to defibrillate ventricular arrhythmias, not necessarily atrial fibrillation. But in my experience, they have worked, most of them, through the device.
Now,
well,
Angela,
if they stop her heart on the table, won't her defibrillator just kick in automatically?
Well, if the defibrillator, usually what they do, if they're going to do it externally, Usually what they do, or we do, is to turn off the sometimes we do this. We turn off the defibrillator even though the pacing is still on. So if the patient goes into significant bradycardia, the pacemaker or the defibrillator will kick in, so she won't have that problem. So she shouldn't have any flat line after that shock. But that thing about stopping the heart is not really, it doesn't really happen, because, I mean, there is a background rhythm that will go, and if the pacemaker or the defibrillator will definitely kick in if that happens. The thing is how you're going to do that defibrillation externally, because you have to use some positions that won't affect the defibrillator itself. Because in a shock, the defibrillator can sometimes be affected.
So if they told the family they're going to stop her heart, that doesn't indicate which modality they'll use to try and cardioversion.
Right. I mean, it's basically a cardioversion of what she's going to get, which is simply a shock to depolarize the whole heart and say, okay, it's like giving a big slap on your face, mm-hmm. and starting over. And then once you basically activate the whole heart, the heart will then recover usually in the normal way, which is the normal sinus rhythm.
So they're really not stopping her heart.
It looks like it's stopping the heart, but it's not really, because, I mean, you will have a heart rate after that. Some people may develop very long pauses, and those patients, you know, the doctor needs to know which one of those patients may have that, so that they can have either a temporary pacemaker or they're ready for it. In this case, it doesn't matter, because the pacemaker or the defibrillator will kick in. Mm-hmm. So there is not that fear. The only fear here will be to put it in a way that it won't affect the defibrillator. Okay. And then to have something to prevent the atrial fibrillation, because most of the atrial fibrillations are successfully cardioverted. The problem is keep them in the rhythm. Mm-hmm. And there's a condition called early recovery atrial fibrillation, or ERAF, and that's you cardiovert the patient has a couple of beats in normal rhythm and they go back to it. Those are difficult, and those require more medications to help us cardiovert.
But they'll know that
during the procedure they will see that.
All right. Okay. Any more questions, Ange?
So you would say that not to really worry about the risk during the procedure?
Well, I mean, there's always a risk,
right.
and you know, usually the risk that I'm also concerned, and we are all concerned, is when, even if there's a presence of a clot there, you know, when you cardiovert and you bring that heart into normal rhythm, by having the normal contraction of the heart, even though it takes about 4 to 10 days for the atrium to really have an adequate contraction in spite of having a normal rhythm, if there's a clot, it will dislodge that. But in terms of statistics and risk, if you do it that way, 4 to 6 weeks with adequate INR anticoagulation or with a transesophageal echo, your risk is much, much less.
Okay. Well, you made me feel a lot better.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for joining us today. And we'll be back in a flash with more. On the line will be Ray. Ray, we know you're there. When we come back from the break, we'll go right to you. Be back in a flash.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you.
Confused about dry eye? Not getting answers as to why your eyes are so red and painful and your blurry vision that gets a little better with a good blink? Now you can learn all about dry eye, the causes, treatments, and home remedies from the number one best-selling consumer book on dry eye problems, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome by Dr. Stephen Maskin. Published by Yale University Press, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome has been selected as a 2008 Best Book of the Year by the Association of American University Presses and a 2007 Best Consumer Health Book by Library Journal. Find answers for your dry eye. Go to your bookstore and pick up a copy of Reversing Dry Eye. You'll be glad you did.
Focus. Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
And welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We are talking with guest expert Dr. Ignacio Gallardo, and on the line is Ray from Brandon. Ray, welcome to our show today.
Thank you. It's very informative.
And thank you very much, and thank you for your patience. How can we help you?
Well, in about less than 2 weeks, I'll turn 80.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm sweating it out, to tell you the truth. I've got other problems, prostate cancer and Crohn's disease, but I had a deep vein thrombosis 4 years ago this month. And they put me on Coumadin, and since then I've developed atrial fibrillation, and I guess I even have an irregular heartbeat. Are those two related, atrial fibrillation and an irregular heartbeat, or is that the same?
Yeah, atrial fibrillation is always an irregular heartbeat, but not all irregular heartbeat is atrial fibrillation.
I see.
The both can be used interchangeably because atrial fibrillation is the most common cause of irregular heartbeat, but it's not the same thing.
Okay. Well, I've been on Tylenol for a while, and even when I'm not taking it regular, my blood pressure is, like 1.8 over 56 or something. But I'm concerned because they put me on Zoladex two and a half years ago. And I had an injury and I suffered bone damage in my spine. And I found out that Zoladex can cause osteoporosis and all kind of bone problems. So I just arbitrarily last year in August, I stopped getting the injections. But I'm concerned that, does that have a history of damaging the heart or affect the heart?
What is the drug again?
Zoladex for the prostate cancer. It's a female hormone.
Yeah, no, I don't think that I know anything about that affecting or inducing atrial fibrillation or affecting really the heart. There has been some relation between your condition of prostate and, for example, deep venous thrombosis, even though most commonly there's no relation, but, in general, malignancy can increase risk for that. And if in terms of atrial fibrillation, which is very common, and I don't know if you have atrial hypertension, which is probably one of the most common causes of it, the fact that you're treating the deep venous thrombosis with Coumadin, you're killing two birds in one shot. So, in that sense, you shouldn't be worrying about clot formation.
Yeah, well, it's been keeping it there pretty between 2 and 3, but I was concerned because I can get out and mow the yard with a push mower and have no problems. I don't create any atrial fibrillation or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like the more exercise I do, the better off I am, mm-hmm. frankly, if I can accomplish it.
Well, no, that's good. It seems like, not everyone that have atrial fibrillation is bedridden or very decompensated or fatigued. Some people are, they even have atrial fibrillation and they don't know it. So there are some people that are more symptomatic than others, and also it all depends on the concomitant conditions that the patient has. But the fact that you are, basically tolerable on that atrial fibrillation and that you've been doing so fine and doing activity, as long as you're anticoagulated, you are, definitely you're okay.
Well, I was concerned that I've lost all my strength. And the urologist tells me that people have been on the Lupron or Zoladex, this is their biggest complaint. You're just you lose all your muscle mass, and you're wasted all the time. You have no true energy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do something, I force myself to do it. That's how I get things accomplished.
Well, Ray, I hope we answered your question today. One final note: if you did not tune in last Sunday, we did a whole show on Crohn's disease.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for crying out loud! No, I didn't.
But there's good news, because if you go to our website, the podcast is there. So if you go to focusonfemales.com, on the home page, left lower corner, left click there, it'll take you to the Radio Health Care page. You can scroll down where there's a library of shows. Last Sunday with Dr. Jürgen Nord from USF, we did a whole show on Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, and you can just listen to the podcast. All right?
That's very helpful. Thank you very much. Doctor.
Thank you for joining us. And the next caller is Ted from Tampa. Ted, welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you, gentlemen?
Good. How can we help you?
I've read recently that there is a little device, filter device, that can be put in the heart and I think the atrial appendage to block clots. And I was curious where that is in development. And that also raises the question of what percentage of clots actually in atrial fibrillation arise from the appendage versus other chambers of the heart.
Well, definitely, the left atrial appendage is over 90% of the time because of the structure of it. It's like a corner that is tapering down, and it just the blood flow is much less there. So when you have stagnant blood flow or stagnant blood, that will induce the clots. But atrial fibrillation itself is also has been proven to have an increase in clotting formation in the heart. So that if you put any other type of arrhythmia compared to atrial fibrillation, other arrhythmias do not produce that clot. But atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter, because atrial flutter is the cousin of atrial fibrillation, and usually they come together. But atrial fibrillation itself has been shown that makes the patient hypercoagulable to produce clots there. There is a device called the Watchman. Before it was called the Plato, and there was not too much of a good resource with that, and there's a procedure called the Watchman. It's a device that that is put in the appendage, and it sort of like block the entry of blood flow in that area, and will, or if you have any clots, it will prevent it from getting out. And there's data that it's getting into more use today, even though it's not standard way of therapy. Some people they recommend doing that, but it's still, I will say, that it's more in the experimental to daily practice, time.
All right. Ted, that's all the time we have for now. Thank you for joining us and asking your question, and hope you tune in next week and the following weeks as well. Ignacio, any last thoughts for our listeners in regard to fainting spells, abnormal rhythms? We have about 30 seconds to go.
Well, next week we will talk about fainting spells.
The beautiful thing about the radio show, you never know where it's going to go. You never know what callers will ask about. So, of course, the information you gave out today was essential and vital for at least one family. I'm sure it helped others as well.
Sure. It is a pleasure to be here.
Okay, next week will be thyroid disorders. At least we'll begin on thyroid disorders with Dr. Roland LaJoy, guest expert endocrinologist. That will be next Sunday, August the 2nd. In the meantime, this is Steve Maskin, hoping that you all have a great week, and we'll see you next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. And once again, thank you, Ignacio, for joining me today.
The Focus on Females Healthcare Education programs are for you. Visit our free 5th annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27th, 2010, at the Tampa Convention Center. And every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic on Talk Radio 860 WGUL. Focus on Females.
What should you